From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's second hour of Forum, journalist and geologist Simon Winchester will join us to talk about the earthquake and firestorm that followed and all but destroyed San Francisco back in 1906. His newest book is called A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 06, and he joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. On the morning of April 18, 1906, an 8.25 Richter scale earthquake along a 300-mile fault east of San Francisco and the firestorm that followed devastated the Gold Rush city of San Francisco. And now we have the story of the world-famous earthquake as told by famed journalist and storyteller and geologist Simon Winchester, who gave us such books as Krakatoa, The Map That Changed the World, The Professor and the Madman. An Oxford-trained geologist and a former foreign correspondent and journalist with The Guardian and The Sunday Times in Britain, Simon Winchester has contributed to Harper's, The Smithsonian, National Geographic, The New York Times, and The Atlantic Monthly. His newest book is called A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. And he joins us here in studio for this morning's second hour of Forum. And delighted to see you again.
Good morning again.
I got to tell you, this book is like reading two books. I mean, it is the story of the quake. It's also kind of the story of San Francisco, but it's also changing views toward the planet Earth. And I thought of something maybe that we could begin talking about in conjunction with an interview I happened to hear that Terry Gross did that many of our listeners probably heard with Joan Didion, who will, in fact, be on Forum in about a week and a half. She was saying, geology is my religion. And I thought, this certainly ties in with Simon Winchester's view.
It is extraordinary. I mean, how she ends that wonderful book, The Year of Magical Thinking, by talking about tectonic plates. It's becoming my religion, too, I think, although I'm not at all a religious person. But when you look at the world, well, I start off the book by talking about how ever since 1969 and the landings on the moon, and we've had this ability to look at the planet as a whole, the fact that this coincided with an entirely new approach to geology, plate tectonics, which allows us for the first time to look at the planet as a whole, has transformed geology. I mean, I hate the term paradigm shift, but that was a real paradigm shift, because before that, people that studied geology were really dull. I mean, they just looked at, fossils and, cross-bedding in sandstones, and it was a very arid science, and no wonder people in this country called it dismissively rocks for jocks and regarded geologists as, up there with the really dullest of the nerds in creation. And then suddenly...
Competing with accountants even, yes.
Oh, well, I don't think it was quite as bad as that. And then suddenly everything changed. We suddenly looked at the planet in its entirety, and geology started to make sense. It certainly did for me.
Yeah, a new geology, like new math almost. It was called new geology, yeah?
Well, I don't know if it was. I mean, I've called it that in this book, and I think a lot of geologists are slightly offended because the people that taught me, who are still alive, say, what do you mean we're being sort of replaced by these new hip geologists? But it seems to me, and certainly the reception of these last couple of books, The Map That Changed the World and Krakatoa, someone said the other day, do you know geology is becoming cool?
Well, you talk about plate tectonics, and you get into the figure. I said to myself, gee, here's Simon Winchester again writing about an obscure geologist, his favorite type, J. Tuzo Wilson. This is the man who we really owe the debt of gratitude for.
And there should be a biography. I mean, he's a great Canadian hero up there with, Wayne Gretzky and Pierre Trudeau and the small number of Canadian heroes one can name. But he changed our view of the world, and very recently, 1965, so that once again, when I was studying, we knew nothing about this. We had no idea why earthquakes happened. We had no idea why volcanoes erupted. Then suddenly, he told us about tectonic plates, and suddenly it all came clear. So we owe him an enormous debt.
So with the view from space and the debt we have to him and plate tectonics, we have really ushered in a new era. We may not call it a new paradigm, but it's certainly a new era. And what's suggested in your work, and we'll get to the San Francisco quake, of course, but using that as an example, I mean, Vesuvius erupted a week before the quake. 4 months after, there was a big quake in Chile, which killed 20,000 people. And what begins to become more clear is how all these dots are connected.
Yes, although oddly enough, within the geological community, that realization has only surfaced in the last couple of years. The notion that certain years, certain periods of time, are much more seismically active than others. I mean, as an example, look at...
Now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And actually, facetiously, someone said the other day, when Winchester writes a book, stay indoors, because nasty things tend to happen. But if you remember, the 26th of December 2003, a huge earthquake in Iran destroyed that wonderful old city of Bam. 26th of December 2004, a year later exactly, almost within the hour, huge rupture submarine off Banda Aceh, which caused the tsunami that is almost certainly the greatest natural catastrophe which any of us will live through. I mean, 285,000 people were killed. Between those two bookends of calamity, if you put it like that, there were a huge number of earthquakes. Mount St. Helens was erupting. There were earthquakes in South America, North and Central America, Japan, China.
Recently, Guatemala.
Guatemala. And now, of course, this recent one up in Kashmir.
Not isolated, you're saying.
Well, no. And the odd thing is that, as you mentioned just now with Vesuvius, 1906 was one of these very unusually active years. It began with a big earthquake in northern India, much like Kashmir, one of 10 days ago. Then it was followed by a huge one on the Ecuadorian-Colombian border in January of 06. Then St. Lucia. Then an obscure place in the Caucasus called Shamarka, then Formosa. That killed 8,000 people. Many, many more of them died in San Francisco. Then Vesuvius began to erupt, as you mentioned, then San Francisco. And then 21,000 people died when Valparaiso was destroyed. It seems as if certain years are more active than others. And the theory that's beginning to sort of bubble its way up among the geological community is that now we know that these tectonic plates exist. Is it not possible that if for some reason that we don't understand, a very big event happens where two of the plates intersect or collide, why does this not result in a sort of setting the whole world like a big brass bell vibrating, and those vibrations course right through the planet and cause earthquakes in other completely unrelated parts of the world? So a big event in Bam triggers an event in Japan, triggers an event in Australia, triggers Banda Aceh, triggers Kashmir. It sort of makes sense, and geologists now, who have for years been searching for this holy grail of being able to predict earthquakes, are now beginning to have that aha moment. Maybe this will help us.
Talking to Simon Winchester, his new book is called A Crack in the Edge of the World. I'm looking at my copy here because it's a pre-pub copy, and yet the publisher's copy has this great fold-out. You came in all excited about that.
It is extraordinary. I mean, there's this wonderful Brazilian designer at HarperCollins in New York who just says, I want to go mad with this cover. And when you take the cover off the book and unfold it like a sort of
accordion,
it becomes an enormous... It's a reproduction in part of the emergency edition of the newspaper that was put out in San Francisco the day after, Thursday the 19th of April, because there were, of course, three papers in town, the Call, the Chronicle, and the Examiner. And so they produced together a rare moment of cooperation, a newspaper called the Call, Chronicle, Examiner. And that emergency edition is basically what this jacket turns into.
You have done, I should add, a prodigious amount of research on this, as is your wont, and some of the figures that emerge. I mean, certainly we know from public records about people like Ansel Adams and Enrico Caruso and their response to the quake and experiencing it, but you bring in figures like Professor McAddy, the one-minute man, you could almost call him, a reporter, a swimmer, an explorer. These are all part of the public record? These are things that you dug up?
Most of them, I have to say, although very kindly, a very large number of people, once they'd heard that I was doing the book, rang me up. I mean, I had a flat here for the 4 or 5 months I was living here doing the research. And they would ring up and say, you know, we've got Auntie Ethel's papers or we've got the scrapbook of Uncle George. And they would lend them to me. And some wonderful material came from that, like the then, I think he was the bishop of the Episcopalian bishop of San Francisco. All his private papers were loaned to me, and a marvellous old man who ran a foundry south of Market. They were just wonderfully kind. It seems that San Franciscans that have been here for many generations preserve all their memorabilia with a sort of eagerness that perhaps others in less historically significant parts of the world do not, and they were happy to share them with me. So if I can, without sounding too cheesy, may I thank people here, because they were very, very kind.
But you did things with a novelist's eye. We had on Carol Phillips yesterday, who's written a historical novel about the black entertainer Burt Williams, and again, he just compiled all this data and wanted to get into the inner life of Burt Williams, so turned it into a novel. What you did, it seems to me, was you were telling the story in your narrative style about San Francisco, as well as, of course, about the earthquake. You wanted to really tell that story, like so many have, but in your way.
Well, who could resist the charms of something like the Hotel Nymphomania? I had no idea that such a place existed. I'm so sorry it burned down or something. It sounded enormous fun, 1,000 rooms. But then it turned out, someone said to me yesterday, that the owner of the Hotel Nymphomania, his descendants, are central to the board of the De Young Museum. So this wonderful museum, which I understand has reopened at last in San Francisco, owes much of its grandeur and standing
to the
Hotel Nymphomania.
I don't know that anybody has made that connection. Actually, there are connections here that, as much as many of the people in San Francisco know about the earthquake, have come through. I mean, you discover things, for example, let's just talk about this, Chinese immigration in the aftermath of the earthquake, for example, or the Pentecostal movement in the aftermath of the earthquake.
They are two, I mean, fascinating sides of this story. Stop me if I become too boring, but I really think the Pentecostal story is amazing. You have this, and I don't mean to offend anybody, so my take on it is like this, that this strange church began in the early 1900s in West Texas, where pastors believed, or at least came to persuade their congregations, that the Lord manifested himself through the very strange behavior of people who came to church. So they would fall about and lose muscle control and gyrate and
call them holy
things.
Rollers.
Well,
so
they're the holy rollers. Or they would start speaking in tongues, either, and I knew nothing about this before I began research, either glossolalia, where you speak complete gibberish, or xenolalia, where you start speaking a language with which you're hitherto unfamiliar, but yet...
I do both on this program regularly.
Well, you're jolly lucky then. The Lord is manifesting himself here. This is wonderful. Hallelujah. So this church took off big time, and it gradually spread not to the east, but to the west. And it had its first manifestation in California in 1906 in a small building previously used as a stable on a street called Azusa Street in Los Angeles, which was at that time a very, very small town. On the Sunday, the 15th, I think it was, of April 1906, the pastor from Texas addressed a very small gathering saying, the Lord works in mysterious ways, and I dare say some of you in the congregation will roll about or utter strange noises, thereby indicating his existence. But something else will happen, my friends, soon. Be sure of that. And this was all religiously, I don't mean that as a pun, but it was reported by the Los Angeles Times. And to a presumably fairly skeptical Los Angeles was the report of this new church and the warning that there would be a sign from God. 3 days later, the most sinful city in America was completely destroyed by an earthquake and fire. The following Sunday, 10,000 people turned up at that church. So many the police had to, there was a riot broke out, essentially. Half of the building was destroyed because the weight of these masses of people damaged it. And the pastor essentially said, I told you so. And that saw the beginning of the Pentecostal movement. Up to that moment, it didn't really have a name. But the Pentecostal church essentially is the underpinning in the Anglican world of the fundamentalist Christians that, you know, Pat Robertson and Jimmy Swaggart and Tammy Faye Baker and all these luminaries, the people who Karl Rove marshalled, of course, 4 million of them, winkled them out of their basements to get to vote for Mr. Bush. So in an extraordinary way...
winkled, that verb.
I hope it's polite. In England, it's okay.
It's original.
And so the long shadow of the San Francisco earthquake exists today in both religion and the politics of the contemporary United States.
And Chinese immigration?
Well, that's interesting too in its own way. For Chinatown was destroyed by the earthquake, and the Irish and the Scots that essentially ran San Francisco did not want them to come back. And indeed, the mood in America generally was terribly anti-Chinese. There was the Chinese Exclusion Act, which actually wasn't repealed until the 1940s. So there was a great hostility towards the Chinese. Most of them went over to relatives in Oakland, but started to drift back in sort of late April and wanted to go back to Chinatown or where it had been. And the city fathers said, not on your life. And they wanted them to go to some dreary little peninsula down near the football stadium here. And they said, no, we want to go back to where we were strategically located between the swells of Nob Hill and the business people of downtown. And the San Franciscans said no. And then who weighed in? But the Dowager Empress herself, still sitting on the throne in the Forbidden City in Peking, who said, I'm sorry, I, the Chinese government, have land on Stockton Street. It's where the Chinese embassy is, or the consulate general. So this is where Chinatown's going to be. Or, America, we will in China no longer trade with you. We'll just cut off everything. We don't care. And so Washington buckled, and San Francisco was made to buckle, and Chinatown was rebuilt where Chinatown exists today. And the whole question of Chinese immigration follows from that, because all the Chinese wanted to come in to do business in San Francisco to help revive this destroyed area of the city. But the immigration rules were incredibly strict because of the Chinese Exclusion Act. And there was a immigration processing center set up on Angel Island, which was supposed to be for Europeans. There was this hope that Europeans would start landing once the canal had been built and being processed in a sort of Ellis Island West. But in fact, it became the main processing station for the Chinese, who started to come in large numbers, because they knew that all the papers relating to their immigration status had been burned in the fire. And so what were called the paper people started coming in, people who claimed to be relatives of people who lived in San Francisco. And it was up to the immigration officers to quiz them, ask them questions, to trick them, and to prove that they weren't, in fact, relatives. And so people were detained for months, if not years, in Angel Island, while immigration officers would ask them questions like, OK, if you are Uncle Wong's relative, how many steps does it take for you to get from the front door of his house back in Fuzhou province to the rice bin? And if they gave the right answer, 26 steps, or they would be let in. But how they got these answers? The cooks who worked in the Angel Island commissary would be told by the would-be immigrants, they're asking me questions about how many steps it is to Uncle Wong, so will you go to Uncle Wong in Chinatown, ask him if he can remember, and then bring me back the answer the next day. And so because of this complexity, they would stay for months, and eventually they would get in, because there was a sort of Darwinian thing about it. Only the really cleverest ones got in. And so, you know, we appreciate and delight in the fact that the Chinese here are very astute, very clever, very sharp. It's partly because of the way, the cunning they had to employ to get in.
Talking to Simon Winchester, his book is A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906, and talking about effects of the earthquake, or as the earth shrugged, as he put it, what happened afterward and after the firestorm. There was also the fact that San Francisco was kind of really deposed and lost its crown. I mean, it was the center of California and it was the major city. After the quake, moved south.
Yes, I mean, a number of things conspired. There was, first of all, this tremendous attempt by the commercial barons of San Francisco to downplay the earthquake, to say it wasn't really the earthquake that damaged San Francisco, it was the fire. And as the fire is something that can be controlled by mankind, it's something we can deal with. We didn't want the word put out that San Francisco was a dangerous city. And for a while that strategy worked. But then slowly, for a number of reasons, one of them, of course, being the eternal sunshine of Southern California and Hollywood, and which came as a consequence of it, slowly the realization began to sink in, unpalatable though it may be to San Franciscans, that this is a place that's vulnerable to earthquakes, whereas Los Angeles, although it gets some shaking, of course Northridge in 1994, it's never going to be as vulnerable as San Francisco will always be vulnerable. And so this, I think, conspired to shift population and importance away from San Francisco and down south.
The I'm sure you're aware, 16 years ago, yesterday was a Loma Prieta quake, and one comes away from your book with the sense not only of all of the detailed and great observational power you have brought to bear in terms of the history, but also it's inevitable, and it's inevitable that it's going to be a major catastrophe. And yet we stay here, we live here.
Yes, I mean, I really don't want... I was nervous coming here to sort of face a San Franciscan audience because, yes, it is inevitable. But on the other hand, so are earthquakes in Japan. I mean, Japan, anyone that chooses to live on a plate boundary, a phrase that we didn't know before Tuzo Wilson coined it in the 60s, anyone who lives in Kashmir, anyone that lives in Sumatra, anyone that lives in Japan, and anyone that lives in California has to be aware that they're living in a very dangerous part of the world. Well, the people that live in Kashmir and Sumatra are economically incapable at the moment of preparing for such an eventuality. The people in Japan, on the other hand, prepare for it not just in terms of construction, but in terms of very, very rigorous drilling. I mean, people are persuaded, enjoined, cajoled, whatever, to go out in the streets when sirens sound every month or so and do as they're told to learn how to deal with an event which will inevitably happen. And as a consequence of that, although there are occasionally bad catastrophes like the Kobe earthquake of a decade or so ago, most earthquakes in Japan kill relatively few people and the affected city is up and running very, very quickly thereafter. The big problem here in the Bay Area, I think, is that although the buildings are now, generally speaking, being brought up to code so that they can by and large deal with a major ground shaking, the people are not trained well enough. There needs to be, and I know Americans are such individualists and Brits as well, one's sort of embarrassed to have to do things in public when sirens blare, but I think it would be a very good idea if earthquake drills became part of Bay Area people's lives.
Wouldn't disagree with you there. In fact, let me invite the Bay Area and those of you listening to us beyond the Bay Area to join this conversation. We welcome your phone calls, some questions and comments you may have about the great earthquake of 1906, about the history of San Francisco. It's all embedded in this fine new work of Simon Winchester's called A Crack in the Edge of the World. We welcome your calls, and you can join us toll-free from wherever you're listening to us or however, on the Internet, on the radio, or on the Sirius satellite. We're at 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available, so give us a call if you care to join the conversation, and I hope you do. It's 866-733-6786, or you can email us, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. And just apropos to what you just said, Simon, the book tells us that the destruction of the city was assured because of the unbridled and unmonitored growth, the kind of, I think you phrase it, slapdash planning and construction, the root cause of the damage of the fire. So preparation is all could be the anthem here. When we come back, your calls and your emails, you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny talking with Simon Winchester. His new book is called A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. And I was just asking about whether or not the quake of 06 still qualifies as the most dramatic natural calamity on our shores in the wake of Katrina. And Katrina may have, as Simon Winchester said, cost more, but the 06 quake is still up there at the top. What about, just quickly before we go to calls, the Richter scale, you know, you read 8.2, you read 8.25, you read 7.9. Maybe, you know, we can just quibble about these things, but it does get confusing to some people.
It does. I mean, basically, 7 and above is bad. I mean, the biggest in the world history was 9.4 in Chile in 1960. The big one in Alaska in 1964 was 9.0, I think, and the Sumatran quake was 9.2. So they're super earthquakes. The ones that are around between 7.5 and 8.5 are really, really bad. But an awful lot depends on the nature of the ground. I mean, if there was a six somewhere near San Francisco, houses in the marina, which are built on landfill, would be very severely damaged. But above eight, everything would be very, very badly damaged indeed.
Of course, we've been talking about the San Andreas fault. I mean, the Hayward fault is just as serious.
The Hayward is the one that's fit to burst at the moment, and that's the one that the U.S. Geological Survey recently put out this statistic, prediction that there's what I believe a 62% chance before 2032 of a 6.5 or over. So that's the one to prepare for. But it's a very active part of the world, and this family of faults are in constant danger of popping.
Should mention, by the way, since you mentioned U.S. Geologic Service, that you'll be there in Menlo Park on Friday at 7 p.m. And these are people who excite you. I mean, despite the fact that some of them are bureaucrats.
I think they're the U.S. Geological Survey houses, wherever their office may be, and they're all over the country, the happiest bureaucrats I've ever met. I can't imagine seeing very many happy people in the IRS or the Department of Agriculture or Commerce, but at the USGS, they're just so enthusiastic about what they do. And they've, of course, with the Bush administration not being very friendly towards science, their budget is constantly being cut. But they do
depends
really...
Depends what science you're talking about.
Well, indeed, yes. Of course, intelligent design, I'm sure we'll get heaps of money. But no, they're a very, very happy bunch, and Menlo Park is, they were enormously helpful to me, but they love anyone that's interested in geology as well.
We'll be there on Friday night. Also, it's Stacy's on Friday in the afternoon, and tonight, or this afternoon at Book Passage, tonight at Cody's at 6 o'clock, Book Passage at 1 o'clock. Just FYI, those of you who want to meet Simon Winchester, and you can meet him now on the air with us. Let's go, in fact, to your calls. Laura, morning.
Good morning. I'm a San Francisco City and County employee, and I'm also someone who was trained originally by the Neighborhood Emergency Response Teams. I currently live in the East Bay, but I wanted to really recommend programs such as NERT and the NEAT program in the East Bay, which train civilians to be assistants to first responders and who basically equip communities to be able to be organized around safety and disaster response. And I would just like to encourage all of your listeners to pursue these programs and to contact their local fire departments to get more information.
Thank you. I appreciate that call. Of course, Americans tend to be very reactive, much more than preventive, I mean, in terms of calamities especially, alas. But we get the message out today, certainly, and you have helped along those lines. Let me go to more of our calls. Brian, hi.
Hi, great to have the show on because people oftentimes forget that we are living in, or don't want to face it, we're living in a fault-active area. I, like the caller before, went through disaster training with the city of San Rafael. And I carry in my company car, I transfer from my personal car an emergency kit. And it doesn't have to be an earthquake, Michael. The other day I was going home toward Calistoga. There's a very windy road that leads from Santa Rosa to Calistoga. And I came across a horrific three-car accident, and I was the only one that had any gear there to help out individuals. And I also would like to put a call out to religions, because a lot of times parishioners can be very helpful in helping out in these kind of situations. I'm a Scientology volunteer minister, and other churches can be helpful during emergencies.
We thank you for that call. You know, Ed, speaking about religion, I mentioned initially that maybe like Joan Didion, the religion that comes across in your book is one of geology. There is this sense of, I mean, you write about early on about the Gaia idea. We might talk a little bit about that. But the idea that the planet is indifferent to us mortals, and we have to kind of be resigned and acquiesce to that. No?
It is like that line at the beginning of War of the Worlds about this cool, indifferent intelligence viewing us from afar and deciding, in that case, to strike and to smite Tom Cruise, which I think is something
speaking
talking
of
about Scientologists
yeah.
that I would happily do. But no, the Earth is utterly indifferent, and we are essentially powerless. And I think one of the problems in America, peculiarly, is that America is such a confident and powerful nation. There is a feeling that anything that nature can hurl at America, America can deal with, thank you very much. But I don't think that's the case, unfortunately. I'm very interested in the notion that in mature countries, and I don't mean that in a condescending sense, I mean in a literally old countries like the countries of Europe and Asia, the cities that exist now are cities are in places that were the right places for them to have been built. So London, Paris, Peking, Moscow, Berlin, they've been there for thousands of years because they're built in the right place, and wind and earthquake, storm, don't affect them much. But at the same time, these countries are littered with the ruins of cities that were built where they should not have been built, like Pompeii and Herculaneum and Ayutthaya in Thailand and Heliopolis and Petra. And we go as tourists to visit these places and are amazed and delighted at ruins. But America's a country without any ruins, essentially. We've got a few ghost towns, and the port of Valdez in Alaska is regarded as a ruin. But essentially, there are no ruined cities in America because America's young enough to still have the confidence to plonk down cities anywhere it jolly well pleases. But I wonder if we look at a map of America in, let's say, 100, 200 years' time, we might as tourists be going to the ruins of New Orleans, because when you think about it, it is sheer lunacy to build a city 20 feet below sea level between a lake and a river in a place that's in the constant path of hurricanes. Similarly, Phoenix and Tucson, maybe even Las Vegas. I mean, these are cities built with no water whatsoever. I can't believe that they will survive for very long. And then one has to wonder about the cities that lie on the plate boundary. If and only if they behave as the Japanese cities do, and Japan will survive, they risk, if they don't, becoming ruins too. And it's an awful thought that if a city like San Francisco does not marshal its energies to do compulsory, let's say, like this lady who talked about NERT a few moments ago, training, and everyone knows how to respond to a catastrophe which will occur, make no doubt about it, then there's the possibility that in 200 years' time tourists will be looking at the stumps of the Golden Gate Bridge and the stump of the Transamerica Tower and saying, what a strange place to build a city. Let's take a photograph of it.
Well, we go to more of your calls. Gail, you're on with us. Good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I've been a real admirer of Mr. Winchester for a number of years. Before I read The Professor and the Madman, I had the pleasure of listening to it on tape, read by Mr. Winchester. And I was really captivated by it and allowed to feel the emotions that Dr. Miner and Professor Murray went through in their journey. And I wondered if, Mr. Winchester, if you have recorded any of your other books on tape.
Indeed, all of them, I'm afraid. So if you're a sucker for punishment, you can even hear this one, which I went into the studio and did about 3 months ago. So yes, it's all there, word for word, read by me.
And thank you for the call. We'll go to more calls, and we'll welcome next Stephen from Bakersfield. Good morning.
Yes, Mr. Winchester, a privilege to speak to you. I'm wondering about the earthquake that occurred in the 19th century in Missouri, which is, my understanding is, that was the greatest earthquake that ever actually hit the United States. And just as a backup to what you just said about it being crazy to build cities where natural disasters are known to occur, wouldn't that indicate that there's really no safe place to build a city?
Well, no, there are plenty of safe places to build a city. And as I suggested a few moments ago, Moscow, Paris, Berlin, I mean, they're perfectly safe places. But in the United States, well, that's another matter, because America is a very seismically active part of the world. And I'm delighted you've brought up the Missouri earthquake. This was in this otherwise totally unknown little farming town called New Madrid in southern Missouri, where Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, and Arkansas all come together. And there was an enormous earthquake, or series of earthquakes, from December of 1811 until February of 1812. Geologists, if you go to the U.S. Geological Survey website, you can bring up a screen. I actually, when I was writing the book, used it as my screensaver, which shows earthquakes in the United States updated every 5 minutes. And there's always a little rash of earthquakes from the Aleutian Islands down through Alaska, down through the Queen Charlotte Islands, and down to California. That's always there. A place like Petrolia in northern Humboldt County has several hundred small earthquakes every day. On the east coast, there are a few around Charleston, because there is a big bad fault there. And yet, always every day, right in the middle of the United States, there are a couple of little squares which indicate small magnitude 2.5, 3.5 earthquakes occurring near New Madrid. Because of this, and I was to there's a big conference of geologists going on this week in Salt Lake City, and the big expert on what's called paleoseismicity, which is old earthquakes, was talking to me. She's a professor at the University of Kansas. She does a lot of work in the northern San Andreas Fault. She was looking at, there was a big earthquake, as I'm sure you know, in San Francisco in 1420, long before San Francisco was founded, of course. But she's looking at the history of old earthquakes in Missouri. And because of the number of them, she recommended to her colleagues at the U.S. Geological Survey that they do a shake, a risk assessment analysis of the two nearest cities, which are Memphis and St. Louis. And Memphis, it turns out, Shelby County, very, very dangerous. So the people who live in Memphis and the people who live in St. Louis are completely insouciant. They have no awareness that they're living in a potentially seismically active zone. So unlike here, which is fully aware but doesn't do an awful lot about it, these people are blissfully unaware. But geologists are sending out an alarm signal saying, you better take heed. If you live in Toronto, you live in New York, you live in Buffalo, you live in Atlanta, you're okay. If you live in Charleston, you live in Memphis, you live in St. Louis, or you live in San Francisco, you're not. You better start thinking about it.
Thank the caller. This is from one of our listeners who says, we've all heard so much about FEMA and local emergency management agencies recently. How much of this type of governmental organization and planning existed in 1906? How much truth is there to these stories of San Franciscans all coming together to help each other?
I think there's a lot of truth in it. It's extraordinary to me how rapidly an efficient response was taken after 1906. I mean, you had soldiers marching from the Presidio to the Hall of Justice 153 minutes after the earthquake. You had Washington meeting, the Congress meeting at 4 o'clock the following morning. You had President Roosevelt and the Secretary of War, William Taft, ordering relief trains out that same afternoon. The first relief train from Southern California arriving in Oakland at midnight on the night of the earthquake. A week after the earthquake, every single tent in the possession of the American Army was pitched in San Francisco to provide housing for the 225,000 homeless people. Within 2 weeks, one-tenth of the American Army was here. And although those big sort of organs of state are remembered well for the speed with which they reacted, I like the stories of the lesser people, and particularly the one that really I find so touching. You hear all the stories about people helping one another, sure, but when a bureaucrat is helpful, then your heart really warms. And this was the postmaster, a man called Mr. Fisk, who said to his staff, a lot of people are not going to be able to afford or going to be able to get postage stamps, and yet they need to tell their loved ones their situation. So he issued a decree without, and this is the important thing, without asking permission from anybody in Washington, the decree saying any letter or card posted in San Francisco and which clearly comes from the hand of a victim but which does not have a postage stamp shall not go undelivered for want of fee. And that seemed to be a wonderfully kind indication of the spirit of the people. So it was hugely different in 1906 and much, much better.
He did it by fiat, though, huh? Without any authority.
That's the point, and so did Funston. I mean, Frederick Funston, the deputy army commander in San Francisco, a thoroughly bad man, by all accounts, behaved appallingly over in the Philippines and made all sorts of racist remarks in America, nonetheless rose to the occasion. I mean, he and this, you know, equally dreadful man, Eugene Schmitz, both were classic examples of, you know, there comes a tide in the affairs of men which, taken on the flood, leads on to greatness. They took decisions rapidly, the decisions that needed to be taken, and San Francisco was put on the road to recovery so much more rapidly than we're seeing in New Orleans today.
On we go. Richard, you're our next caller. Thank you for waiting.
Yeah, Mr. Winchester, being an amateur astronomer, I'm wondering, I've read some reports about the correlation between the 11-year sunspot cycle and earthquake prediction. Do you have any of that information or I've come across any of that research in writing your book, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thank you for the call. Well, sunspots and earthquakes.
First of all, I'm fascinated that you're an astronomer because I traditionally buy myself a present when I have a new book coming out, and what I've just bought is a wonderful new telescope, and I'm starting
what
to get...
What kind?
It's a Celestron 9 1/4-inch Smith Cassegrain. So I'm learning my way around the skies as we speak. I have read the 11-year sunspot cycle, the indications that maybe it's connected with earthquakes, but I think the answer is no. And equally, there is no indication that animal misbehavior, snakes that suddenly go ramrod straight,
dogs going nuts
or getting lost, or elephants going berserk in hotel rooms, as happened before Krakatoa, there's any real correlation. So I'm afraid we have to look literally more deeply in the earth and not at sunspots and not at snakes.
Do better with palm reading, probably, than many of these kinds of things, don't you think?
Something I've always relied on, yes.
In fact, one of our listeners says, how are the earthquake predictors doing? And the fact is, probably not much better than they were doing 10, 20 years ago, 100 years ago.
No, with the single exception of what we were talking about earlier, this notion that big events may set off a cascade of smaller events. I mean, one very interesting thing which has come to light in the last year or so is the realization that every time there's an earthquake, a large earthquake in Alaska on the Denali Fault, which is loosely connected with the San Andreas Fault, the frequency of the eruption of the geysers in Yellowstone National Park changes. Not Old Faithful itself, but some of the lesser geysers that normally erupt very, very regularly, let's say every 50 minutes, suddenly, for about a week or two after a big earthquake in Alaska, 2,000 miles away, they start erupting every 40 minutes or 30 minutes. They start going much faster. Another indication that the world is much, much more connected than we thought it was.
And we have been able, pretty incontrovertibly, to prove that there's a connection between volcanic eruptions and earthquakes, haven't we?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt about that. It's a very different kind of earthquake and a much lesser event. And, of course, volcanoes are eminently predictable. So of the three scourges, we can now see hurricanes coming towards us, or typhoons, as they're called in the southern hemisphere. We can see volcanoes beginning to bubble up. I mean, Mount St. Helens in 1980, a classic example, when the whole northeast face began to swell like a great sort of pregnancy, and then it erupted. And Dixie Lee Ray, if you remember, was able to evacuate people by fiat. Well, they can't do that yet with earthquakes. They're trying very hard. They're putting lots of money. The big experiment that I know you all know is going on down in Parkfield, California, is attempting to look at sort of little signals that might be sent out from the fault before it's about to give. But it's going to be a brave geologist that says to a mayor of a city, you're going to be hit, evacuate your people. And it's going to be an even braver mayor that says, something's going to happen, get out of town. Because crying wolf is going to be something that people are going to be really tired of.
Let's bring our next caller on. Jeff, you're on. Hi.
Oh, thank you very much. This is a fantastic program. I had a question with regards to the subduction zones along the coast of California, and the one that runs all the way up into Seattle. And they said that, I wonder how far down in the ocean they can go in order to, find where the subduction zones are. That's the first question. And the second one is an article that I read in the Scientific American of this month called The Big Dig that the Japanese are doing, called the Deep Earth Exploration. And they're going into the mantle. And do you think that that would have any real insights as to the causes of earthquakes for the people on the crust of the earth?
Yes, I mean, both of these are fascinating topics to me, and I don't want to get too technical and boring about it, but basically, as we all know, the San Andreas Fault marks the division between, on the western side, the Pacific Plate, and on the eastern side, the North American Plate. The Pacific Plate is moving forwards at an inch and a half a year northwards, and it's being kept in place by friction. When that friction gives, the earth moves suddenly, causes an earthquake. North of the what's known as the Mendocino Triple Junction, which is offshore off Cape Mendocino in Humboldt County, a new plate kicks in, and that's the Juan de Fuca Plate. And that, instead of moving northwards, is diving under the North American Plate. off the coasts of Washington and Oregon. And it's a classic subduction zone, and it is manifest in interior Oregon and Washington with all the volcanoes. They've got volcanoes of a type that do not really exist in coastal California, which, like St. Helens and Rainier and all the rest of them, erupt from time to time. That is known very well, and the depth of seismic activity is plotted, and so people in Oregon and Washington know as precisely as Californians what is happening seismically to them, and of course, because it's volcanoes, they have more time to prepare for them. The question of the deep drilling program, the Japanese doing what people attempted to do 20 years ago, to drill through this thing called the Mohorovicic discontinuity between the crust and the mantle, will give us enormous amounts of new information, as will the hole that's being drilled into the San Andreas Fault in Parkfield. But these are hugely expensive experiments. And in a time when science is given fairly short shrift by cash-strapped governments that have other priorities like Iraq and so on and so forth, these kind of experiments, which I think are absolutely vital to human existence, are fairly low priority. So, you know, if it's a question of voting, writing your congressman or whatever, the kind of science that the USGS is doing with the help of the National Science Foundation and which the Japanese are doing to find out what's going on in the deep earth, absolutely vital.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of our emails here. This comes from a listener who says, your guest mentioned that there is, speaking about information, a website that has constant updates on earthquakes. Do civilians and the general public have access to this site? And if so, what's the address?
It is usgs.gov, G-O-V, and you can work your way through, navigate through, and you'll find it very easily. There's one big map of the United States, or there's one big map of the world. And then for a big map of California, showing the minutiae of the details of California, there's a site which is linked to from the USGS site maintained by at Berkeley. So there's tons of information, and absolutely everyone has access to it.
And here's a listener who is a retired geologist, a woman who says it would behoove us all, especially policymakers and pundits, to acknowledge the wisdom of Will Durant. And she gives us this quote, civilization exists by geological consent, subject to change without notice. Alas, we forget, she says. Here's something, I don't know if you can answer this, Simon. Ben writes, I live in Antioch, where I purchased a home 5 years ago, and the agent told me Antioch is not prone to quakes. I wrote that off as puffing. However, in the last 5 years, I have not felt one moment of shaking. And talking to longtime residents, they seem to agree Antioch does not quake. Any opinion?
Well, I can't speak specifically for Antioch, but as you'll know, there's the legislation, the Olquist-Priola legislation, which requires very sophisticated shake maps of every county of California to be prepared so that you can see where the high-risk zones are.
And they are everywhere, are they not?
Well, they are most notably. The town which amuses me, perhaps amuse is the wrong word to use, is Portola Valley, which is a town 25, 30 miles south of San Francisco, where extremely wealthy people, many of whom made their funds, of course, from the Silicon Valley boom, choose to live. And yet it is right on top of two of the most active fault traces of the San Andreas, with the police department, the school, and the town hall built such that the San Andreas fault goes right underneath them. It is sheer lunacy to build a town on top of, when you know it, and it should never have been built. And inevitably one day, I'm afraid, although it's convenient just to have another glass of Sauvignon Blanc and forget about it and go off on your bike or something, but that town is going to be hurt badly.
Let's try to get another call on here, and that's you, Dan. Morning.
Hello. Mr. Winchester, I've enjoyed several of your books, and I look forward to reading this one. I resisted the temptation to buy it just last week, but I'm going to get out there as soon as I get...
Can't resist anymore, huh?
Yes, exactly. I've lived in the Bay Area since, actually, September of 89. I was in Berkeley in October that year, and have sort of been living with them ever since. Earthquakes of different sizes and learning about them. I was really sort of shocked and taken aback by the photos that I saw following the Kobe earthquake in 94? It wasn't just the extent of destruction, but the sight of or images of freeway overpasses toppled over, buildings not even just collapsed but toppled over, and I guess I sort of thought that somehow Japanese engineering and technology would be such that their buildings would do better. Maybe nothing can really stand up to strong earthquakes. I guess I live in an area that was heavily logged. Redwoods were starting to, were taken out of this part of the Santa Cruz Mountains shortly after 1906, and I wondered if you could comment on high-tech versus low-tech in terms of cities that are going to remain near earthquakes. Is there some combination of this, of good engineering, but also going back to wood frame houses that seem to have done so well in San Francisco in 1989 versus the masonry houses? Is there some combination of high-tech and low-tech that needs to be employed by cities, planners, builders?
Right, Dan, I think we've got the question. We've got a little time left, so please.
Yes, I mean, very, very briefly, you're absolutely right. I mean, the high-tech solutions, if you're going to build high-rises, they can be intelligently designed. The Japanese have learned an awful lot. That spectacular picture of the expressway in Kobe going down, the Japanese road building techniques have advanced hugely since then. And down in Southern California, the research is producing incredibly sophisticated new buildings. But you're equally right. We could all live in yurts and we'd survive very happily. Thank you. Low-tech, high-tech combination, but training, training, training.
Again, the book is A Crack in the Edge of the World. Simon Winchester, always a delight to have you here, even though the shadow is being felt here. But thank you for those important and cautionary words, for the caveat and the admonition as well. Appreciate your being here. And again, you can see him this afternoon at Book Passage at 1 o'clock and tonight at Cody's at 6 and Stacy's on Friday and the U.S. Geologic Service in Menlo Park, 7 o'clock on Friday. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Kevin Guillory, and Ariana Picari. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Thank you for being a part of today's program. We'll be back with you on tomorrow. We're going to talk about the German elections tomorrow, and we're going to meet Francis Moore LePay, an old friend who has written a book on democracy. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.